The following presentation is from North Pine Baptist Church. We trust that it will help you learn more about God and His message for the world. For more information and to connect with us, visit npbc.org.au.
Well, thank you for coming out. It's always good to continue to grow and to learn. So the focus tonight on the talk is 1 Corinthians 11, 17 to 34. I'm going to use the ESV version. We'll read through it. And the idea of this talk is to give us a context of the social context, the cultural context of this particular verse, and get an understanding of what's going on within this particular verse with regard to the Lord's Supper, which we commonly call communion. So let's read the text first, 1 Corinthians 11, 17 to 34. But in the following instructions, I do not commend you, because when you come together, it is not for the better, but for the worse. For in the first place, when you come together as a church, I hear that there are divisions among you, and I believe it in part. For there must be factions among you in order that those who are genuine among you may be recognized. When you come together, it is not the Lord's Supper that you eat, for in eating one goes ahead with his own meal, one goes hungry, another gets drunk. What? Do you not have houses to eat and drink in? Or do you despise the church of God and humiliate those who have nothing? What shall I say to you? Shall I commend you in this? No, I will not. For I receive from the Lord what I also delivered to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the night when he was betrayed, took bread. And when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, "This is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me." In the same way, also, he took the cup after supper, saying, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. For as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. Whoever therefore eats the bread or drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty concerning the body and blood of the Lord. Let a person examine himself then, and so eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For anyone who eats and drinks without discerning the body eats and drinks judgment on himself. That is why many of you are weak and ill, and some have died. But if we judge ourselves truly, we would not be judged. But when we are judged by the Lord, we are disciplined, so that we may not be condemned along with the world. So then, my brothers and sisters, when you come together to eat, wait for one another. If anyone is hungry, let them eat at home, so that when you come together, it will not be for judgment. And the other things I will give direction about. The other things I will give directions when I come. So you don't have to be a biblical scholar to understand that there's a lot of significant differences between what's going on in Corinth at that time, first century, and our setting today. That piece of bread, which is 1 centimetre by 1 centimetre at the most, will not get rid of your hunger in any way, shape or form. You can hardly call that a meal. And that little cup, beside the fact that beside the interesting observation that there's enough wine at church for people to go home drunk, we do not have alcohol in our little cups. But if we did, I think you would have to drink all the little cups by yourself to perhaps be able to get drunk. And so there's obviously a setting issue going on here, between what's going on in Corinth and what's going on in our social context as well. And so what we're going to talk about tonight is not just the social context as applies to Corinth. This is a social context that would apply right across the Roman Empire, which means that there is the potential for what we're going to call Corinthian communion chaos. There is potential for that to happen right across the Roman Empire, particularly on the north of the Mediterranean, where Roman architecture, Roman social structures and all that sort of thing are very strong. As you get around further to the east of the Mediterranean, into Judea and Jerusalem, not as much Roman architecture. As you go down to the bottom, it's much more influenced by Egyptian architecture and background and everything like that as well. So we've got to keep those sorts of things in mind. But definitely across from what we would call modern-day Turkey, right across through to what is modern-day Spain, these things that we're talking about would apply. And so while it's not uniquely a Corinthian problem and could be a problem in other churches, we also want to recognise that the fact that Paul only mentions this in the Corinthian context does say something about the Corinthian church. So there's some caveats that we want to talk about. Now, the factors that contribute to what's going on are two issues, and the first one is an issue of town planning. Again, right across the Roman Empire, this is the case, particularly in larger cities, and we're talking here about Ephesus, Philippi, all of these sorts of cities that are mentioned, Thessalonica, it would be the same in all of these cities. The reason, if you were here for my last talk, why I use Corinth as an example is because of all of the cities from the first century, Corinth has had by far the most archaeological focus over many, many years. And so Corinth is actually a really great example of just how many people have come into, how much learning has taken place around a whole range of issues. That's why we often use Corinth as a basis for a lot of these sorts of things. So when it comes to town planning in any particularly large town, we need to remember that there's a church, it's trying to find a place to gather. Okay, a large group of people is trying to find a place to gather. That's happening in the first century churches, especially as time goes on and there's more and more people who are gathering for church. Where do you go? So you need to find a public building to be able to do that, or a large building. Now, in any particular situation, temples are prolific in all sorts of towns. The temples are by far the biggest buildings in any footprint that have any footprint in any town, but obviously you worship the gods there. So for the Corinthians and the church to come to a place and use a temple as a place of worship where there's all these false gods and all these idols and everything like that, that's not going to be able to work. Also, while it is true that in the Roman Empire that all religions were tolerated and there would be temples that would be dedicated to multiple numbers of gods, remembering that they're polytheists, so they worship all sorts of gods and everything like that. Ironically, when you come out and say, yeah, but we worship the only true God, then you're not allowed to use the temple anymore. So, you know, there's tolerance, but only to a certain degree of tolerance, which is you've got to tolerate everyone else as well. So, for the Christians, the temples, biggest buildings, they're out. The other buildings that are bigger, we mentioned in my last talk as well, we talked about the gymnasiums, which were large places of social gathering as well. Certainly they would have been able to hold 50, 60, 70, up to 100 people quite easily. Again, these buildings are dedicated to the gods. And also, the person who heads up the gymnasium, his name is the gymnasiarch, he would not tolerate hosting a group of people who would come into his gymnasium with espousing a philosophy that says there is no worship of Caesar. So that would be a real issue for the first century Christians. So these big buildings, the gymnasiarchs, they're also out as well. Within any setting, that you've got the stadiums and all of those sorts of things, you wouldn't be able to use those for church. The theatre is the same. They're far too big, 3,000, 4,000 people in a theatre, 20,000 in a stadium. So they're out. There are government buildings that could be used where people would gather and for meetings and all of those sorts of things. But again, the government buildings were used for things like town planning, raising objections, politics, guild meetings and all of those sorts of things. And even though religious issues were addressed, worship issues weren't. So those buildings are out as well. We also know from the first century and from our scriptures that when Christianity first spread, the building that they went to first was the synagogue. which was often would have been big enough to house a number of people. And if you know your New Testament well, you know that that lasts for 2 weeks or 3 weeks, and then, well, you're not allowed to talk about Jesus here anymore, and they kicked out. So in any town in the first century in the Roman Empire, all of these public buildings and all of these big spaces, they're all out for the first century church. And that's the reason why the early church met in homes. A lot of people say, oh, they met in homes because they were setting up a biblical model to meet in homes. And you'll have people today who say, oh, you know, the only way to have church now is house church, because that's what they did in the first century. But they did that in the first century not because they were setting up a principle of how to worship together, but pragmatically, that's what they did. The houses were the biggest buildings that they could sit in and they could gather in as well. And so there were houses that were big enough to hold groups of 40 to 60, and that's where the Christians gathered. Aquila and Priscilla, you can look this up for yourself later if you want to test the scriptures, don't believe just what I say, but Aquila and Priscilla, we know they'd set up at least two home churches, one in Ephesus and one in Rome. In the book of Philippi, we read about a church that meets in the house of Lydia. We read about that in Acts 16. The church in Colossae meets in the house of Philemon. Colossians 4:15 tells us that the church in Laodicea meets in Nympha's house. And Acts 12:12 tells us about Peter when he's miraculously released from jail and he walks through the streets and then discovers that he's out of jail, that he goes to the house of Mary, who is the mother of John, whose name is also Mark, where a whole lot of people have gathered together as well. So there's a likely description there of another house church. The general scholarship consensus is that in Corinth, by this time, there's not just one house church, there's multiple numbers of house churches, and that Gaius was one of those who used his house. We might not be talking about Gaius's house particularly here, but we've got a lot of evidence of these early churches that were meeting in big houses. Now, when we think of Roman houses first century, I think this is often the picture we come with our minds. We have big houses, big courtyards, all of those sorts of things, elegant decorated rooms. These villas, they're called domus, and they look like that. Is anyone watching the most recent season of Chosen? Oh, okay. There's in there, they end up being set in a house for a really good period of time, and it's a Roman house. It's a really good depiction of what it was actually looked like and everything like that as well. So you can go and do that. So this is perhaps, when we talk about Roman housing and all that sort of stuff, this is perhaps the sort of idea that we have. What we need to recognise is most Roman citizens did not live in houses like that. In fact, they lived more in houses like this, which are called insula, so apartment buildings. We've got to remember that while Rome is a rich city, there's a lot of people who live in the Roman Empire, a lot of people who live in the cities, and so it's closely dense. You don't have the luxury of being able to say, well, let's just spread out the city because, well, you've got to transport and all of those sorts of things as well. So cities didn't spread out like they do in our day and age, because we can jump in our car and drive. But cities in those days, everyone had to walk everywhere. So this urban sprawl idea and everything just didn't happen in the first century, not in Rome, not in Corinth, not in Ephesus, right across the Roman Empire. They would dense them in as close as they can to keep people as close as possible. Often these insula, the ones in Rome were taller. The ones in Ephesus are only two or three stories, so they're not as big, but they could get up to seven stories high. Often there would be shops in the very lowest section, and then the most wealthiest people or the richest people lived on the lower floors, because no lifts in those days, so the higher you went, the more you had to walk upstairs and everything like that. Lowest people could also have running water and indoor plumbing. As you get higher, the capacity to have running water decreases as you get higher. Also, the population density also gets higher. Upper floor residents had to rely on the latrine, which is the public restroom. So you can imagine being on the seventh floor and going, I need to go to the toilet, I need to come all the way down those stairs, and then I've got to go outside and find the latrine. So while it was forbidden to throw bodily waste onto the streets, that law was frequently ignored by those who lived on the top stories of those buildings. So you can imagine what these buildings look like and how badly they smelt and all of those sorts of stuff. I also want us to not picture this idea of you've got the really nice houses all in one area, the domus all in one area, and then all in another area is the insula. They would actually be all amongst each other. So there would be this big villa, the Roman domus, in this area, and it would be surrounded by these insula in a suburb. Also, the insula, these buildings here, were often owned by the people who owned the domus as well. So that was the upper class, called the equites, and those who rented them are the lower and middle class, and they're called the plebs. So that's, we still call people plebs today. I don't know if that's a saying, you know. No, that's a, no, too young. Okay, but a pleb is just someone who is less. Okay, so this is just, you want to picture these sorts of things. This is what's going on in a city where the first century believers are gathering together, they're trying to worship and all of those sorts of things. Now, when the church met in the home of Aquila and Priscilla and Lydia and Nymphia and Philemon and Gaius, you can be sure that they weren't the insular design. We know that 100%. There's just not enough room to be able to gather the church in those people, a church in those things, which is really interesting. That people who talk about house church today, that's what they imagine, you know, in a lounge room, 10 or 6, 8, 10, 12, you know, that sort of thing. And it just wasn't how it worked, because the houses were too small. So what you can be sure is that these people, Aquila, Priscilla, Lydia, Nymphia, Gaius, Philemon, even John Mark's mother, kind of to a certain extent, because the remember, they're in Jerusalem, so the house architecture is quite different in Jerusalem. We talk more about the upper room, okay, that the upper room is large. They tended to have a lower floor and then an upper level, and that was the bigger area where people could gather and everything. Kind of a different design to a domus, but enough to be able to gather people together. But you can be sure that anyone who is mentioned that they're in a house church and it's the name of that person, you can be sure it's one of these. It's the domus style of building, not the insula. So Philemon was a rich man. We know he's that because the church meets at his home. We know he's also rich because he owns a slave, at least one, probably more. Lydia is told, we know that Lydia is a person who deals in purple fabric. In those days, the colour purple was the most expensive to be able to produce, and so Lydia would have been a rich woman as well. So when we're talking about house churches, we're recognising that they're gathering in buildings that look like this, and that someone in that church is reasonably wealthy or quite wealthy to be able to own a domus, and then the church gathers into that space. Now, these houses, this is... they've got two, in the houses, there's two big gathering areas. One is called the atrium. Remember a couple of weeks ago I talked about the shrine idols and everything like that as well, and we pointed that out. So there, that's that. So this is a picture here. This is from Pompeii, excavations from Pompeii, which are really also great. Pompeii, because of the volcano, preserved everything. And as they've unearthed it and all that sort of stuff, they've been able to unearth highly preserved buildings and everything like that as well. So Pompeii is actually a really great example of what first century architecture looked like, and the preservation of colours and all those sorts of things as well. This is a photo of an atrium at a building in Pompeii. This is the sort of room that they have. Obviously, Priscilla and Lydia would have removed their shrine from their particular home and all that sort of stuff. Here's another picture. So that's another picture of a different atrium, also in Pompeii. The right-hand side is what it looks like today, and then the left-hand side is an artistic representation. And all atriums had a hole in the roof. That's how they were all designed. And the reason that they were designed like that is that when it rained, the water would collect in the pool there, and this would be the source of your water for your home, okay? And it would be create that gathering point for all the water and everything like that. The advantage of having that is you would have indoor running water, but it also functioned like air conditioning, okay? Because you've got a big pool of water inside your home, you run a bit of a breeze through your home and everything like that, and you create air conditioning as well. So they're not as, uncivil as what we might think. The point I'm making about this particular atrium, this room could hold about 40 to 50 guests, okay? And recognising that they were kind of indoors, but if they were raining, it was kind of outdoors, okay? That's sort of the description that we've got there. The other room was called the triclinium. The reason it was called the triclinium is that there was these special couches in there that you kind of leaned on, and you could fit three people on there. So tri is three, and clinum, you might think of the word incline or recline, so they all relate to the Latin. So basically, you've got this room where there usually are three couches with three people who can lean on those couches, and this is the room where the formal food gets delivered and everything like that, where there is a meal together. It's very luxurious. Okay. So I've used some words here: domus, insula, atrium, and triclinium. Okay? This is a background, a town planning background to what's going on behind 1 Corinthians 11. Because as we think about Corinth and we think about the town planning, I also want to now go across to social expectations. And the two things are kind of linked. And we want to remember in the book of Corinthians, and Paul does it in this text here as well, but from the opening of the verses of Corinthians, he has the welcome. And then in verse 10, the first thing that he says is, "I appeal to you, brothers and sisters, by the name of our Lord Jesus, that all of you agree and there be no divisions among you, but that you be united in the same mind and in the same judgment." And as we read chapter 11 and 17, 18 and 19, he says again, he talks about the division. And so Corinth had this real issue with division, and it came over into the church as well. So spiritually, the people in Corinth have a real issue with the sin of division. As I said, the general consensus, the scholarly consensus, is that Corinth had multiple numbers of house churches. That's based on a number of things that the different people who are mentioned, the divisions and all of that sort of stuff. But we also want to remember that Paul's ministry in Corinth lasted for 18 months. And so he was preaching, teaching and all of those sorts of things as well for 18 months in that particular city. And we know that people came to faith, and we know that the gospel was transforming and everything like that as well. So there's scholarly agreement that he didn't just leave one church behind. He actually left multiple numbers of people. One church being, 50 to 60 or 70 people at the most. And so there's this sense of going, there's multiple numbers of churches that are meeting across the town of Corinth, which is quite a large town. So you want to have houses strategically placed that people can go and visit as part of church and everything like that as well. And so that's the picture that we want to have in mind. Now, I want us to understand that the fact that there are multiple numbers of house churches, that's not the cause of the division. Okay, that's just a pragmatic solution to where do we gather the people together. We're thinking about Corinth. We're thinking about big houses. We're thinking about the fact that in each of these churches, one of the church members would have a house big enough to be able to house all the people in the church, remembering the name of that is Adonis. Thinking about the fact that most of the other people in that church, they live in these apartments, the insula. Then, as we gather for church, and let's imagine it's a Sunday, we're gathering for church on a Sunday, all the church gathers and they go, they don't have to go very far, they don't have to walk across town, remember they're all amongst the Domus, or all amongst the insula as well. They go into the house of the Domus, and in the house there are two rooms. There's a triclinium that can hold 9, and there's an atrium that can hold 40 or 50. And we know that Corinth is very socially divisive, and we know that that division is coming over into the church. So, who ends up in the triclinium and who ends up in the atrium? Well, the rich people are going to end up in the triclinium, and the poor people are going to end up in the atrium. And so this recreation of the social context and everything like that, and understanding town planning and looking at the scriptures and saying, well, there's obviously division there, and we know that a lot of this has to do with class and all of those sorts of things, and Paul talks about a whole range of things, of people who even look down at Paul because he hasn't got good speech and all of those sorts of things. We can recreate this picture, which I think is quite accurate, of the church gathering together in this particular home or a number of homes in Corinth, and on the basis of social class are ending up in two separate rooms. A group of people, 9 over here in the triclinium, another group of people, 40 or 50 over there in the atrium. And in that context, as the church is together, they celebrate a meal. Actually, what happens in Corinth is that they celebrate a meal within a meal. So the church in Corinth, in chapter 11, the Lord's Supper is being celebrated amid a church-wide fellowship meal. When you come together, it says, it is not the Lord's Supper that you eat. And then he talks about the Lord's Supper from verses 23 through to 32. Now, he's not saying when you've come together, you haven't eaten the Lord's Supper. What he's saying is, you've come together, you're meant to be having communion, the Lord's Supper together, but because something's going on, it might look like you have celebrated the Lord's Supper, but actually you haven't. So there is definitely communion, the Lord's Supper, taking place. We can be sure that that is the case. But there's also this other meal, this fellowship meal, that is taking place at the same time. And it's a meal where the people are not eating together. It's a meal where they could have eaten at home and got rid of their hunger beforehand, but they didn't. It's a meal which is not the Lord's meal. So in the text there, and a lot of verses do it, but take those two words, that word for supper and that word for meal, in the Greek, they're exactly the same word. Okay? So it says, it's not the Lord's meal that you eat, for in eating, each one of you goes ahead with your own meal. So it's talking about two different meals. There's the Lord's meal, and then there's your own meal. So what's happening here is that there's a division that is taken place at a fellowship meal, which has invalidated the eating of the Lord's Supper to such an extent that in the Lord's eyes, it is as if the Lord's Supper has not been eaten. That's what's going on in chapter 11. Are you following me here? I hope this is helpful. So there's a complex of issues going on here. We need to, if we only picture chapter 11 as just the Lord's Supper, we're going to get really confused about what's going on, about how is it possible that people can go home drunk or be hungry. If we only see it as the Lord's, as just a meal, then why does he talk about the Lord's Supper at all? So we need to see it as a meal within the meal that's taking a place in the Domus where people are separated, in Corinth, which is notorious as a city for division, and that division has come into the church. All right. So that's what's going on. And in that context, there is this group of people who, when in their eating, each one goes ahead with his own meal. One goes hungry, another gets drunk. And then verse 33, so then, my brothers, when you come together to eat, wait for one another. So the complexity of this whole issue is that the translations have not always been as strong in explaining what's going on. Because if you look at that, it feels like what's going on is, all right, we're all going to go to church. Let's say, we don't know if it's Gaius' house, but just let's say, we're all going to go to church, we're going to Gaius' house, and as people are arriving, Gaius has got some food, that food going and everything like that, and people are just starting to eat. You know, we're not waiting for everyone else. If you're a typical Baptist, you've missed out by the time, because you're always late, so the Baptists are missing out, the Anglicans, the Reformed people, they're definitely there early, whoever it is. We sort of picture this. It's like, oh, we got here, and we're gorging ourselves with the food, so that by the time the stragglers have arrived, there's no food. Yeah? That's sort of, when we look at the ESV in that way, it feels like that's what's going on, the way that it's describing this idea of waiting. And the translations there, ESV and a whole lot of them, they translate it similarly, because the words that are used behind go ahead with and wait for, that's the common way that you would translate it. But it can be translated another way. It's a less common way, but it's just as legitimate, where it would read something like this. For in eating, each one consumes his own meal. One goes hungry, another gets drunk. So then, my brothers, when you come together to eat, welcome one another. So that's also a very legitimate translation. And this is a translation that more and more scholars are leaning to as they look into the verses and everything like that and have an understanding. Because the culture of the day was, right across the culture, when you gathered together for a banquet, you would not just go ahead and eat. That it was just really impolite to do that. The culture, like the general secular culture, just wouldn't accept that that's what it is. That's not how it works. And so this idea of going, well, obviously people are going ahead and eating the food and others are getting left, it's foreign to the context. And so this is why people are saying, if I think about the context, I think about the possibilities of translations and all of those sorts of things, we're actually leaning to a different translation. Also, when you read through, if you read through it again, verses 17 through to 33, you note the number of times that it says, come together. We have come together. It's actually used 5 times. So that you've got this picture of the church has come together. The church has gathered together. And verse 20 specifically in the Greek says, they have come together in the same place. So the more recent scholarship has been moving away from this idea of, oh, they're just coming and then people are eating as they get to it too. Well, we've actually all come together and now we're going to eat. You start thinking about what that means. That now we're going to eat. And in the togetherness, there are still some who go hungry. And there were still others who get drunk. What would it take to do that? To get that end product if we've all come together? Well, the only solution, and the solution that comes back to where we were, is that there are a group of people, most likely the rich, and they're sitting in the triclinium, and they've been served, and they're getting all the good food, and they're getting all the good drink, and this small group of people is having a great time. And then the host, who would be providing a whole meal, that's often what would be the case, has provided another meal out there for the 40 or 50. But the way that banquets worked at that time, when the wealthy host gathered people together, as I said, he usually provided, they usually provided all of the food for everybody. But those who in the triclinium, they would get the choice food and they would get copious amounts of food. And those who are in the atrium, they would get much less food to distribute amongst themselves. And they would have much less choice of food as well. When you put that all together and then you think about what's going on in Corinth, you go, this is horrendous. This is a horrendous situation that's happening in the church. That the body of Christ has come together, and while they are together, there's a group of people over here who are, they're not even watching them, they're listening, because it's a different room. They're listening to all of the fun and all of the food. They're watching the servants going in and out, continuing to bring all of this food, and they're sitting here with less food, less quality, treated second class, treated third class, within the one body. So that's the meal. And then at some point, someone says, well, let's have communion together. So, we get together, we break some bread, we have a cup, and we share it around. And visually, it looks like we're all together. Yeah, that's how it would have been. There would have been, following the way that it was implemented, and Paul talks about that. He gives very clear instructions. This is what Jesus said. This is what Jesus did. He broke bread. He distributed the cup and all that. So we can be assured that that's not being celebrated in two rooms. That's being done together, and we're having a fellowship, that communion fellowship together, the Lord's Supper fellowship together. And we're all standing here together. And then Paul looks at that and he says, but you're not doing the Lord's Supper. You look like you are, but you're not. Because the way that you did the fellowship meal beforehand makes it very clear that you are not united. That there are people who are treated much less. And so in that particular circumstance in Corinth, the communion is a facade. It's fake. It's just a farce. And that's the situation that Paul is assessing. And Paul's assessment of this is... Paul's assessment of it is, it's scathing. He says, I have no praise for you. You are doing more harm than good. You are humiliating fellow believers. You are sinning against the body and blood of Jesus. You are being judged and disciplined by the Lord. When I come, I will say even more to you about this. It's not the Lord's Supper that you eat. You read it, it's a scathing report on what's going on in the Corinthian church. Do you see what's going on here? Okay, by understanding the context, by understanding the social, by understanding the expectations, by bringing in the biblical information that we have and everything like that, we start to get a picture. Because this verse has confounded people for years. You know, it's like, what's going on here? How does all of this work? And just pulling these little bits of pieces together. I'm not saying this is, you know, 100% how it is, but this is a really good way, I think, to explain what's going on. Okay, now comes the harder part, or the more personal part. It's all very well for us to sit here and go, well, thanks, Alan, that was brilliant. No, you don't have to say that. That was reasonably okay. We can understand, as we go back, we can understand what's going on in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. But what does it mean for us today? You read these difficult passages, or you read these different things. What do we do with that to bring it into our context today? And this is where we need to start asking some harder questions, and we may want to try and answer them, but I think it's possibly worth thinking about outside of this context. But thinking about in our context, we don't usually have fellowship meals within the Lord's Supper. You know, we usually have communion quite separate from all of those sorts of things. And that's okay. That's not wrong or right. It just is. So this idea of, hey, we've come together, we've had this meal. Oh, you know, it's been obvious that there's a separation and everything like that. And now we're celebrating communion in that space. Obviously, we can see those. It doesn't work like that. But what we need to ask ourselves is, in our context, is it possible that we're doing things, or do we need to be aware of the ideas or things that are happening within the life of our church where it might not be exactly the same in the process, but the outcome is the same? Where we're celebrating communion together, but actually, because of other issues that are going on, we're not celebrating together. So questions that you start asking are there divisive secular social expectations that we continue to uphold within North Pine Baptist Church Fellowship? That was an issue in the first century. These different social expectations and class structures and all of those sorts of things, and I'm the owner of the house, what all that sort of stuff, that was being transferred straight across into the life of the church. So for us to think about 1 Corinthians 11 today, we ask ourselves, what are the social structures within the life of our secular time here? And is it possible that those social structures and secular structures, that we allow them to come consciously or unconsciously into our churches, and that creates division? Now that's a question that you ask as you try and apply these sorts of things. Another question that you would ask is, are there fellowship scenarios where the same group of people are consistently unseen and divided off? That's a question that comes out of this. Is there things that we do, again, consciously, unconsciously, where the same group of people kind of get the favours and other people don't kind of get the favours, or they're unseen, or they're undervalued, and all of those? They're not easy questions to ask. They're very uncomfortable questions to ask. But these are the questions that we need to ask. Do we think that we have an equivalent situation where one goes hungry and another gets drunk in the situation where the same people are always getting the best of the fellowship? That's the question. One goes hungry, another gets drunk. Paul is scathing on that. Where there's the one who always gets the same. And that's what we need to understand. It's not like different groups each week, each time they get together, that they take different turns getting drunk. It's the same people. Now, I'm imagining after church or after a gathering every Sunday, remembering that the Domus is in the centre of the Domus and the Insula are all together. So they'd all be walking home, and there might be a couple of other richer people who are going to their own Domus, or maybe they live on the bottom story of the Insula, so they get a bit more of a favour and all of that sort of stuff. And you can imagine the family that lives on the top of the Insula walking home, and they're hungry. And every time they come away from being at church and having a fellowship meal, they're hungry. And you can imagine what it does to those people. And then while they're walking home, Stephanus is being taken home in the cart by his slave because he's drunk again. Yeah? And this family's walking home hungry, and Stephanus is getting dragged along in a cart by his slave, singing the drunk songs that he always sings when he goes home. And this happens every single time that they get together. Now, that's the situation that we're talking about. Is this what's being created? Is there a situation that is created? This is more out of the social context rather than the scriptures. Do we have the equivalent of the 9 in here and the 40 out there? They're not the comfortable questions to ask at all, but they are the right questions to be asking out of this. And then out of this, if this is the case, if this is the case, do we have the courage to call it out? Yeah, because it's one thing to go, yeah, I kind of see it, or maybe it is, or I feel like this, but do we have the courage to call it out? Because we're talking about really divisive stuff here. We're talking about stuff that could be embedded. We're talking about stuff that doesn't get seen because we see it so much in the socials, in the secular social setting, that we don't even perhaps think it's an issue because this is just what everyone does. So this chapter here, this is kind of why I chose it. It's like, you know what, there's a lot more going on here than just trying to understand what's going on. It's actually a picture of what's going on in fellowship in the life of the church. And then recognizing that it reveals itself, it actually reveals itself when we gather for communion. That when we gather for communion, we want to be able to say that what's happening at communion is true unity. That it's not a farce, that it's not a pretend, that there aren't people who are sitting here who feel unseen and undervalued, that there's not those who are perhaps favoured more and others who are favoured less, that there's not this sense of, as we go away, that people are thinking, you know what, it kind of was gathering together, but I really wasn't. Not because of the Lord's Supper itself or communion itself, but because of something else that's going on in the life of the church that's impacting across. If it isn't true communion, then there does need to be confession and reconciliation. That's a conversation for another day because conveniently we're running out of time. But we need to be willing to ask these questions. Because we don't just want to go through this academic exercise and say, yeah, that's really great that we understand that. And then not be willing to also ask the questions. So really, what we want a commitment to is we want to be committed to any action within the life of our church today that creates Corinthian communion chaos. If we see that, then we need to be willing to say, this is Corinthian communion chaos. And Paul asks the church there to discern, to seek repentance, to discern the body, all of these sorts of things. He calls them to account, to move away from Corinthian communion chaos to true fellowship, gathering around the table of the Lord and right across the life of the church. Okay, thanks for listening. That's my last little bit of stuff for the third Monday night talks.
Thanks for joining us for this presentation from North Pine Baptist Church. For more information and to connect with us, visit npbc.org.au.